Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and I am joined for the second time on this show by the one and only, the voice of the Blue Jays, but for me, more importantly, in a way, the voice of Canada basketball as well. The one and only Dan Schulman of Sportsnet, and I guess CBC as well during Olympic time. Just Dan, thanks so much for taking the time and doing this. But and how crazy has your summer been? Just with everything going on.
Yeah, this is a little different. Trying to mix the Olympics in the middle of a baseball season. So very grateful to my bosses at Sportsnet who let me do this every summer Olympic cycle. But yeah, between the preparing for the Olympics, the men's and the women's tournaments, and then the physical, getting over there, getting time adjusted, doing a bunch of games, coming back, jumping right back into baseball. I'm not as young as I used to be, so I'm not gonna lie. There were some pretty tired days, but it was all a wonderful experience.
What's that like, maybe just for you, that adjustment from, we talked about it last time you were on the show, the difference in the rhythms of basketball and baseball. But what is it like to go from, a 162 game baseball season and that grind, and then having to at the same time study and prepare for 24 teams and just and jet lag and, getting acclimatized to a new city and everything?
It kind of feels like you're studying for final exams and you got one of those schedules where they're all in the same week. Like all your buddies have them like spaced out and all of yours are coming at you at the same time. So obviously I started working on the basketball several weeks in advance and just kind of tried to spend an hour or two a day. Okay, let's do Serbia men today. Okay, let's do Belgium women today, that sort of thing. Part of it was just finding the information. It's a little trickier. It's not like just looking up the Toronto Blue Jays or the New York Knicks or whatever, it's but over time I've gotten a little bit better at that. And I was very glad I started early because I landed in France on Friday and our first two games were on Saturday. So there we kind of knew what the schedule was going to be for the first few days. And of the 24 teams, as you mentioned, 12 men, 12 women, I think I kind of prepared for 20. There were like three or four where I said, I don't think we're going to get them. As it turns out, I think we did get one or two of those, but it wasn't until the second week.
Okay.
So, it was kind of like get through today, figure out tomorrow, get through today, figure out tomorrow, that sort of thing. Kind of like final exams in school again. So the other thing too is the baseball season is the ultimate marathon. And a FIBA tournament, whether it's the World Cup or the Olympics or whatever, is the ultimate sprint. So they're very, very different. So it's not so much switching sports from like slower sport to faster sport. It's more about, boom, these games are coming at you fast, and every single game is so incredibly important.
How like for you, especially, not just switching sports, but switching partners in the booth, and Megan Rapinoe was great, and Abdul Karim as well. But what's that adjustment like to kind of get the cadence, the rhythm of, your partner in crime, I guess, or however you want to describe it?
Well, Megan and I had worked together on the Tokyo Olympics. So we were remote. We were together at the CBC studios in Toronto. So we had done 20 some games together 3 years ago. So that was easy. That was like riding a bike. And Nabil's great. I mean, again, he was the reporter, not sitting right beside me as the analyst. So that's not as, interconnected a relationship, if you will, on the air. But off the air, great guy. We all spent a ton of time together. Nabil and I didn't really know each other. Nabil and Megan didn't know each other. So, but everybody got along great. A really wonderful team. So that's something because I'm getting old and I've been doing this for so long. I wouldn't even know how many partners in I bet you I've had over 50 partners between basketball and baseball. So I'm used to, hi, nice to meet you. Let's go do a game. It doesn't happen all that often, but it's happened before. And so I'm fairly comfortable with that. I always believe a play-by-play announcer should, help set the analyst up and bring everything out of them. And I give Megan a tremendous amount of credit. She's fantastic, but her two jobs in Washington, she's a play-by-play announcer for the Mystics and a sideline reporter for the Wizards, and now she's being asked to be an analyst, and she just did an incredible job, and we had a lot of fun together.
Maybe with that, to quickly to go to baseball, just because you're with Buck all the time, how much easier does it help, your own job when you have that chemistry of years and years
Sure.
to?
Yeah, whether it's Buck or Joe Siddall, who I work with a lot too, whether it's Jay Billis or Dick Vitale on college basketball, who I've worked with so many times. But specifically to Buck, like there are times something on the field happens and he and I just look at each other And I know we're thinking the same thing. And he knows we're thinking the same thing. And it might just be like a, you want to say it or should I say it like that?
Yeah.
It's almost like a married couple, right? Like we've just been together so long. So yeah, there is a an ease there, a comfort there. That's nice. But with Megan, it might have taken us, you know, the first quarter of the first game to get that rhythm back. And we did 26 games together. Like that's a lot of games. So you know, if I'm listing everybody I've ever worked with, I've probably done close to 50 games with her. That's more than I've done with most of the people that I've worked with. So it all went great.
Before I get to the basketball itself, it's interesting because your role with the Jays and even with CBC and Canada Basketball, you're neutral, but you're also there's a clear home team. And I know you were saying that when Canada was down in the quarterfinals to France, you weren't getting too kind of upset. But is that something where in the moment it's hard to do? You literally put a clause in your contract to be at the Olympics. Like,
Yeah.
just what's that like for you?
Yeah, it is. So, like ESPN's a different animal. If I'm doing Duke, North Carolina, I am completely neutral. If I'm doing Kentucky, Kansas, I am completely neutral. When you're from Toronto, when you call the same team all the time for the Blue Jays, it's natural. When you're Canadian and everybody knows you've been wanting to do Canada basketball stuff forever, it's natural. So, you remember the Spain game from the World Cup. Everybody could hear how excited I was. It was disappointing. I haven't watched the game back, to be honest with you. So I don't know exactly how I sounded, but it was disappointing. And I felt it more after the game. I mean, in the moment, you're so in the moment. And they were down 12 to 2 and they started coming back. And there were a couple of moments in the fourth quarter. If they had just made that one shot or just gotten that one stop, maybe they could have pulled it out. It was after the game where we took off our headsets and went, oh man. Because when you lose the quarterfinal round is always the cruel round to me. Because if you win the quarterfinal, even if you lose the semi, you still get another game. You're playing for bronze and you're alive for 5 or 6 more days. You're still alive no matter what happens in the semifinal. When you lose the quarter, you pack your bags and you go home. And it's just sudden pain, disappointment, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, when we took off our headsets after that game, we were all kind of deflated, to be honest with you. And you and I had messaged a little bit about how I thought they would do before the Olympics. And I'm a big believer, and still to this day, people underestimate how many good players there are all around the world. People underestimate the continuity that European teams have in their national programs. And people forget this is not a 4 out of 7 like the NBA or the NHL or Major League Baseball. If Canada and France had played in a best 4 out of 7, I'm convinced Canada would have won. But in one game
In
in
France.
France, it happens. But yeah, it was disappointing. I had hoped, full disclosure here, and nobody asked me on, not one person asked me on the record before the Olympics. Maybe that's not true, but nobody's like flat out asked me, how do you think they're going to do? How far do you think they're going to get? Inside on my way there, I said, if they can get to the semis, that's great. And then you just see what happens. That's kind of where I thought they were. The United States is the United States. And I thought and think that Serbia is great. Like they're great. And then I thought Germany was great, the defending World Cup champion. So to be honest with you, I kind of had, if it had gone according to plan, and as you know, nothing in FIBA goes according to plan ever. But I kind of thought USA, Serbia for gold, Canada, Germany for bronze. Now the matchups didn't work out that way, obviously. But to overlook a France and Australia, Spain and Greece, it's you can, I know I'm yelling it into the void because people just count up NBA players and say, oh, they've got the second most NBA. It doesn't work that way. So, but to answer your original question, it was really disappointing. It was still an amazing experience. That USA Serbia semifinal was fantastic. Fantastic. One of the best games I've ever been lucky enough to call. And the USA France game was pretty damn good too. But I'm not going to lie, I would have loved Canada to have gone further.
How much do you think maybe this was an opportunity missed? Because as you said, the world, the you can see it just in this Olympics, right? The women's, the USA barely sneaks, by France in the finals. Obviously, the Serbia USA game will live in infamy. And if Serbia just makes a couple more threes down the stretch, the USA, with a super team goes out, right? And I just wonder if this was the kind of moment in time where maybe the world hasn't caught up to the likes of Canada and USA as much as they might in 4, 8, 12 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, I think every cycle more and more teams catch up. I mean, I know it was a friendly, but USA 101, South Sudan 100. Like, what else do you need to know? And I wasn't as familiar with most of the South Sudanese players. I was familiar with some of them through college or MBA, but they weren't even on, they were on nobody's radar before that game, that exhibition game against the United States. I think the world continues to catch up. You look at some of the players on Serbia who most people would never have heard of, or France, Yabusele and Lasort and Cordinier. Most people know them now. Not very many people knew them before. Who's to say that the 11th and 12th man on an NBA roster, whatever his nationality is better than those guys? I'm not going to say that. I don't think it looked like that in the Olympics. Those guys played better than a lot of guys on other rosters, including Canada's. So, missed opportunity, yeah, because if they had beaten France, if memory serves, they were on the Germany side of the bracket, right? So then they go play Germany in the semis, and who knows? Again, and I don't think Canada was destined to win the gold medal here. I am not one of those people. I've done enough FIBA and watched enough FIBA to respect tremendously players around the world. It only to me is a missed opportunity if they can't bring as strong of a team into the next cycle. Otherwise, I just look at it as a step along the journey. A disappointing one? Absolutely. A failure? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I will never think that this was a failure. If you ask 99% of people, where did Canada finish in the Olympics? What place did they finish in? They won't be able to tell you. They won't even know. They finished fifth. I know fourth would have felt a lot different, and third certainly would have felt a lot, but they finished fifth because they were the highest ranking team based on the first round out of the teams that lost in the quarters. If I had said to you 2 years ago, Canada is going to have a third and a fifth in the World Cup and the Olympics, I think most people take that. But the World Cup inflated expectations, I think a little bit high, a little bit too high, in my opinion. But you know what? In Spain and Greece and Australia and other countries, they're also saying, man, we were this close. This is FIBA. This is how it works. This was a big speed bump. Again, very disappointing. Not gonna deny that. But in FIBA, you have your ups and downs. Argentina did not even make the World Cup last year. There were 32 countries there, and Argentina was not even one of them. It happens sometimes. So to me, the critical thing is to learn from the experience. Why didn't they go further? How do they fix it? And there's some obvious and probably some more subtle things. In hindsight, I thought there were some warning signs in the first three games. Not even in hindsight. I mean, they won all three, but they were all close. And they were in a tremendously strong group where I said, I know I said this publicly before, anybody can go 3-0, anybody can go 0-3. And to illustrate that, I think Canada beat Spain, it was like by 3 points or something. Like it was right down to the final minute. If Spain wins the game, Spain wins the group. Spain loses the game, they don't make the quarterfinals. Margin for error is paper thin. So they were in the toughest group, but I thought there were some warning signs in the first three games. And I give France a lot of credit. They had a tremendous game plan and they executed it perfectly.
You talk about maybe the areas that they can improve upon. How much do you think maybe size, that was the thing everyone was talking about, and missing Zach Edey, which is at least it seems as though he'll be part of the future going forward into 2028. But you can only take the guys that are from Canada to play for your country, right? It's this isn't the NBA. You can't super team or get guys along. Just where do you think are the areas of improvement for this team moving
Size is definitely one of them. So Zach Edey's interesting because where I thought they got hurt size-wise was not so much at the five spot. And I know basketball's positionless now, but like in the France game, It was the four spot, if you will. It was Lesort or Yabusele either being guarded by Brooks or RJ Barrett or them switching on to them. You know, Canada used a smaller lineup because it was a tremendously successful lineup for them in the World Cup and at times in the group phase games in the Olympics. And, you know, so you had Dwight Powell out there as the five, but in the starting lineup, it's Brooks or RJ who are the quote four. And Rudy Gobert, fake finger injury, real finger injury, I don't know, I don't care. But Coach Colet took him out of the game. Like Rudy Gobert was a non-factor in the game. And then Wembanyama, who was really good, but he went to the bench with foul trouble. And my memory gets a little fuzzy. But in the second quarter, that's when France, I mean, they started strong and they kept going strong. And it was Lesort and Yabusele who were just kind of dominating. And so Zach Edey, yes, I want to see him a part of the program. I think it's a wait and see in terms of does he have enough mobility to guard pick and rolls and go out on shooting bigs and all that. But to me, it's not even Zach Edey. If he can help, great. He's a five. Everybody knows he's a five. It's the four spot where I think they really got hurt. They don't have, I mean, they had Olynyk and Powell and Birch and Lyles. None of those four guys, in my opinion, were great matchups for a guy like Yabusele. Too mobile, you know, athletic and mobile, big and strong enough to go down and play bully ball, but can run around and step out, hit a three. He can put the ball on the deck. It's that 6'8", 250, versatile, strong, powerful four. I think that's what Canada needs. You can't grow them in a lab. You got to find them. And, you know, in the next cycle, Leonard Miller might be a part. Omax Prosper might be a part. But again, that's not who they are. They're longer, leaner, different kinds of guys. So what I think France did well is say, here's our advantage, and we're going to exploit it until you force us to change. And Canada didn't really force them to change. You know, they, Jordy stayed with the small lineup, but again, it had been very successful. Second half went to a bigger lineup a little bit more, had Olynyk in there a little bit, not too much. You know, I think we saw a little bit of Olynyk and Lyles together. I can't remember exactly, but they need more size. But I think one thing that I was a little worried going in about the quote five spot, and in the end, it was the four spot that really hurt them. So, you know, maybe Cabangeli can be that guy, although I think he's more of a five too, you know. So I don't know who that guy is, but size is an issue. Yes, it's you can have advantages when you're playing small ball at the offensive end, but they got burned at the defensive end. And then unfortunately for Dylan Brooks, he had his one-off game in that game. Like they had Shai Gilgeous-Alexander doing amazing stuff and just exhausting himself on the court. RJ Barrett had a great Olympics. I think a little bit overlooked how good he
He
was.
played great.
Yeah, but Brooks, who was in, here's the other thing. Brooks shot 59% in the World Cup from three, 59% from three. It's unrealistic to ask Steph Curry to shoot 59% from three. It was unrealistic to think, oh, everything Canada did in the World Cup, they're going to do again in the Olympics. It doesn't work that way. And then I thought their depth would be more pronounced, and their depth just didn't step forward. You know, Jamal Murray didn't play well. Unfortunately, Nickeil Alexander Walker really struggled to make shots. And, you know, he's been a good performer for them in the past, was very good in Victoria, had some good games in the World Cup. So they didn't overwhelm teams at the guard and wing spots to overcome their deficiencies in the front court.
Is maybe the saving grace, you know, Jamal Murray, we'll see in 4 years from now, but just that you have a player of the likes of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who, you know, you look at that Spain game that I know you'll remember fondly, where he just, him and Dylan Brooks just took over, and he's just that superstar that, you know, even if, the rest of the world catches up, you still have arguably the best player on the court at any time against the team.
The first thing, like the biggest, like it's funny, people will say to me about the Blue Jays, you know, what's the biggest key? The biggest key is always Vladimir Guerrero Jr. because he's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. What's the biggest key for Canada next time? We can talk about 100 things, get size, blah, 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 blah. The biggest key is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being on the team. If he's on the team, they have a chance to win any game almost any game they play, and depending on who's around him. And I think if he's on the team, others are on the team. I'm hoping and assuming you can like that Shea's going to be there and RJ Barrett's going to be there. There's no reason to think those two guys were. You'd love to see Dylan Brooks there. Lu Dort, to me, is a tremendously important part of this team. Maybe not as a starter. Maybe they have to look at it a little bit differently next time. And he's a weapon off the bench to say, that dude on that team is hot. Go in and wreck his life for the next 5 minutes, you know, that kind of thing. I think you got to have those four guys. I'm fully expecting Shaedon Sharpe and Benedict Mathurin to be a part of this. If you've got those six, oh, and Andrew Nembhard, who I think who had one great game and otherwise had his ups and downs, but he's a terrific young player. So those seven guys, you're loaded at guard and wing. Zach Edey, I got to believe, is going to be a part of this. If you have those eight, that's a good start. But of the other four, like three of them have to be big guys. And again, maybe it's Omax, maybe it's Leonard Miller, maybe it's Cabanagelli. I don't know. There's the makings of a very good team there, but there's still the makings of a roster that's a little tilted, a lot tilted in favor of the perimeter.
I'll transition as best as I can, as you said, from Shea to Vladdy, and the Blue Jays, and you know, it's obviously been a disappointing year in terms of, you know, wins and losses, but I can tell you as a Jays fan, I swear I check every, you know, on the Score app, and I look, how did Vladdy go 2 for 5? Did he go 3 for 5? You know, I've been just on the Vladdy watch all summer. What's that been like for you, just to cover a player playing just that well at, you know, such a high level day in and day out?
It's fun. I mean, because again, he's only 25. Like some of these new rookies or second year players are older than Vladdy. Will Wagner's older than Vladdy. Spencer Horwitz is older than Vladdy. And that's not to knock Will Wagner or Spencer Horwitz. That's to say, look at what this guy is doing. Now, he has his critics, and I get it because last year he wasn't great. And he's kind of been like this in his career. Is he a phenomenal player or a good to very good player? You know, this year he's having probably his second best year, but it's pretty close to the great one that he had in 2021. Statistically, it's right there in a couple of respects. So it is fun when every at bat could be a moment. I hope they sign him. He's a free agent at the end of next year. I worry if they haven't signed him by spring training, he's going to free agency. I hope they want to sign him, feel they need to sign him, and do sign him. I think he can be a recruiting tool, like Shea, to bring other guys into the program. I think he sells tickets. And I think he's got a chance to be a special player for the next decade. There's always a risk if you're signing a guy to a 10-year contract or whatever it is. I also worry a lot if they don't sign him. Well, first of all, who are you going to go out and get to be like that? And second of all, if you don't sign him, there's a pretty good chance either the Red Sox or Yankees do because they get in on that level of free agent. So I usually straddle the fence a lot more than I'm doing right now in this, but I really think they need to sign him, and I'd love to get a buzz on my phone any day now or an early in October saying the Blue Jays have called a press conference. I think they need to do it.
What's your sense of maybe his, you know, maybe taking it out of the NBA realm, where it's like, does he want to stay, you know, like being around the team all the time? He's said things in the past that seem to be like Blue Jays for life,
Yeah,
along those
I
lines.
think he'd love to stay. I think he's very happy. But I know the one thing I always say is, well, what else is he going to say? Like, you're not going to say, it's kind of bad press to say, I don't want to talk about it. I'll see when I'm a free agent or anything. So again, I think he's very happy. And I think he can be very happy for a number of years. I think he loves Toronto. I think he's got a ton of friends, but Vladdy makes friends in a heartbeat anywhere that he goes. But he has said all the right things, 100%, and I think he means them. But if he became a free agent and the Dodgers offer, or the Red Sox, or the Cubs, or whatever, made him a much better offer, he's going to go. Like anybody is going to go. He's not going to give him a big hometown discount or anything, nor should he have to. So I believe he wants to stay, and I believe they could make him an offer that would make him stay. But I'm always cautious about delving too much into the comments or the minds of players, because I sometimes think, well, how would I answer that question if I were that person? And so he has said all the right things, and I believe in his heart that he would stay if they made him a fair offer.
what do you make of maybe the third base position, him playing there? Is that to maybe augment his, a potential contract? Do you think it makes sense for him to play at third base at all? First base, just what are
I
your
think it
thoughts?
depends on what's on the market. They need another legit power hitter, like a really good hitter. If that guy's a first baseman, if that's all they can get by trade or free agency, then I think they move Vladdy to third. The other thing, maybe not full time, the other thing they can do is leave the DH spot available to rotate players through. So whoever it is, if they get a big power hitting first baseman, that guy can play some first in DH. Vladdy can do third first in DH if he and they are willing to do that, to bounce him around a little bit. George Springer can DH a little bit more, that sort of thing. So I think you can almost, I think the one of the worst things a team can do right now is sign a guy who can't play a position. Like, he's got to be a stud, Edgar Martinez, Frank Thomas, David Ortiz, he's got to be a stud. Otherwise, I don't think it makes sense. So I think everything's got to be on the table, and they've got to see what's available in the offseason. The power hitter could be an outfielder. He could be a third baseman. He could be a first baseman. We don't know. This could go hundreds of different ways.
Yeah, it's been the Vladdy and Bo show for 5 6 years now in Toronto, and Bo Bichette, obviously, like, Vladdy's up at the end of next season and will be a free agent. What do you think happens there? Do you think that they can get a deal done with him? Do you think if he's not, if he doesn't say he wants out but that he's not re-signing, that they'll trade him in the offseason? What do you think happens there?
I think there are a lot of possibilities. It would stun me if I woke up to a message on my phone saying they traded Vladdy. Stun me. It wouldn't stun me if it happened with Bo. I'm not saying it will happen or should happen, but it wouldn't stun me. Behind the scenes, maybe they're having conversations with both of these guys. And if a guy says, you know what, I'm going to free agency, first of all, that's his right. It's his right to Fred VanVleet bet on himself. That's an athlete's right. But if a player says, I'm going to free agency, thank you very much, but I'm going to free agency, whoever it is, then it's on the team to do what's best for the team. And maybe that means a trade. So I think it could go a lot of different ways. I mean, first of all, let's see Bo come back in the next couple of weeks, which it sounds like he's going to, and hopefully finish the season strong, even if it's just 2 or 3 weeks, to let him look and feel like himself, and then see where they're at. But in the offseason, I think this front office has to consider, and I think they know this, has to consider almost everything. Because certainly the way they handle the trade deadline suggests they think they could contend next year. A healthy, happy Bo Bichette is a great player, and he can certainly be a part of that. But I don't have a feel for it. I think it's likely he's back. But I would, again, I wouldn't be shocked if he were traded in the offseason.
What do you think of maybe the proposition of both those players coming back to Toronto in, spring training without contract extensions or deals done? Does that make sense for a team that, maybe they're a contender to some degree, like a playoff contender, but they're not a, almost regardless of what happens in the offseason, they're not going to be a bona fide World Series contender?
Probably not. I mean, you never know. Baseball's funny. Like, who had
It
Texas and Arizona in the World Series
is.
last year? And so,
Exactly.
they both easily, like with a week left in the season, they both easily could have missed the playoffs, easily, and they wind up in the World Series. So I'm a little uneasy about both guys coming back in the last year of their contract. Then you play out the season, and if it's July and you're not in it, then it's easy. Then you have to trade both unless they want to re-sign with you. So, I'm a little uneasy about that. But teams can't force players to sign. They got to make them a deal that the player and the agent feel is fair. The closer a player gets to free agency, the more likely he is to want to explore free agency. So this to me, and I'm sure people say this every year, just like they say, boy, the NCAA tournament's crazier this year than it's ever been. It's crazy every year. So this is the same kind of cliche statement. This winter feels like an enormously important winter for the Toronto Blue Jays, not just for 2025, but for years to come as well.
You alluded to how the Jays approach the trade deadline and kind of getting guys that young players, but that are on the precipice of, and playing in the big leagues right now for them, with Wagner, Loperfido, all those guys. Where do you see, as being around the team for so many years and they've taken the step back, like, what is that pathway to becoming a contender, and in your mind, for this team?
Well, I mean, Vladdy's got to be great. Bo's either got to be very good here, or they've traded him for something that helps them a lot. Bassett, Gausman, and Berríos, that goes without saying. Those are your guys. Hopefully, Yariel Rodriguez and Bowden Francis are good too. The next wave, the Horwitz and Lopez-Fido and Wagner and Barger. And I'll throw Ernie Clement in there too, and I'll throw Davis Schneider in there. I hope he can get it going again because we've seen it. I think all of those guys can help, but that group is not your second, third, fourth best players, probably. Like, those are good players. They can help, but I don't know that any of them is a star. I'm very intrigued by the upside of Joey Lopez-Fido. I'll tell you that. I want to see more and more and more of him. But whether it's a Springer having a resurgent season, Bo having a resurgent season, or again, somebody's got to be here who's not here now. And we all know who the free agents are, whether it's Alex Bregman or Christian Walker or Pete Alonso. And I'm much more in favor of some of those than others, whatever. Don't need to get into that. But somebody really good who's not in this organization now has to be on this team next year, in my mind, for them to have a chance. I don't think it can be. Well, let's get this decent player and that decent player and that decent player. I think you got to go out and hope that this younger wave you have, those are the decent players. Those can help you in complementary roles, but they got to get a stud or two. I think they do. They've got to put a little bit more around Vladdy and if Bo is on the team and Bo as well. So I think they need a dude, maybe two, for them to be bona fide contenders next year.
The fan base has had a lot of vitriol for the management and GM Ross Atkins over the years. They're now almost at a decade under the helm, have not won a playoff game. I guess just what do you think when you look back, and obviously Ross Atkins can, could easily still be the GM next year, but when you look back at maybe the tenure of Ross Atkins, what kind of comes to mind is what's happened here in Toronto?
Some good, some bad. I mean, you get they signed Lourdes Gurriel Jr. That works out great. Trade him away. That trade's not very popular. Although Dalton Varsho is a terrific player and has helped them in many ways. But the Gurriel Moreno trade, they gave up a lot to get Dalton Varsho. So you trade for Teoscar Hernandez, great. But then you trade him away, and that trade's not very popular. Like, it's not as negative as the haters want it to be, but obviously. Overall, it's not great. I think some of the acquisitions that they don't get credit for, they should get more credit for. The two things that jump out to me on the other side of the ledger is the farm system hasn't produced consistently enough, in my mind, that it should have. I think if the farm system had produced more, maybe they don't have to make this trade or that trade or sign that guy so they don't have enough money for this guy who would have been better. That sort of thing. So one, I don't think the farm system has produced as much as it should. And I think trading Gurriel and Teoscar in the same winter was a lot. And I agree that they needed to kind of tweak, just like Canada, perimeter bigs, you've got to balance it out a little bit. I understand they had to balance it out a little bit, offense, defense, base running, all the different aspects of the game, but right-handed batters, left-handed batters. I'm a big believer that they were way short on left-handed batters. They certainly aren't anymore, but you hope some of those lefty batters are good enough to be good left-handed batters. But I think they overcompensated a little bit too much. I thought Teoscar was going to be traded. I did not think Lourdes Gurriel was going to be traded.
Was there a
But
reason for that?
the Diamondbacks, pardon me.
Was there a reason that you thought Teoscar would get traded and not Guerrero?
I just thought. They really, really, really wanted to improve the defense and balance the lineup a little bit. Now, the Teoscar trade didn't balance the lineup, although I always tell people, they got Eric Swanson and Adam Macko, but they also freed up $12 million and they signed Kevin Kiermaier. So they improved the defense. They got a left-handed bat, not a Teoscar level bat, obviously, in doing that. So I just thought if you're going to make meaningful change, you have to trade a meaningful person. And I just, it wasn't going to be Vladdy. It wasn't going to be Bo. It wasn't going to be Springer. I just thought Teoscar was the guy who was going to be traded. I never expected Gurriel to be traded. So I just think maybe they tilted too much in the direction of here's what's wrong, we got to fix it, and they went a little bit too far. And Kiermaier had a very good year for them in 2023. Kevin Kiermaier was not a part of the problem at all in 2023. But like in Marcus Semien had an extraordinary year in 2021. In effect, he became Matt Chapman. I know a different position. So you lose some offense there. You get great defense, but you lose some offense there. And just year by year, just a bat, a spot didn't hit as much. A spot didn't hit as much. And also Vladdy didn't hit as much in 22 and 23 also. So they just went from an offensive juggernaut, which had deficiencies in other areas, to a team that tried to, be good at everything, and they just kind of fell short. It just didn't come together. So it happens. But I think we have seen from this trade deadline and this draft, I think they've done a better job. Nobody wants to be where they were this year to trade eight guys. But I think they did we won't know for years, really, but I think they did a good job of getting some talent back into the organization, getting some left-handed bats into the organization. And in the draft, they kind of went heavy college. And to me, that suggests that they want guys who are going to be ready to help soon. Last year, Arjun Namala, they take a 17-year-old in the first round, and he could be a star, but it's going to be a few years. They went heavy college players this year, and I think that's them saying they know they need some guys soon if they're going to continue this window and not tear it all down. But so much feels like, after 2025, if and when Vladdy and Bo are free agents at that point in time, that's a fork in the road moment. Are they here? Are they gone? Is the team good? Is it not? This could go so many different ways, and that's why I think it's such an important winter for this team.
Well, thank you so much, Dan, for taking the time and doing this. I just want to kind of share a kind of cool moment. And I know we've talked about it a little bit, but what's it been like just for you you're not sharing the booth with your son, but I guess is it a adjacent booth? I don't know how it works with your son.
The radio booths are one, they're on the 300 level, TV's on the 400 level.
Okay.
So yeah, if I
What's
had like a stick and a string, like a fishing rod, I could lower something to him. So, but it's very fun. He's loved sports his whole life. Obviously, I'm his dad, so I've seen that. He still likes me, which is nice. We get along really well, and just to be able to talk baseball all the time, not every day, but we're each driving home, after the game. And sometimes I call him, sometimes he calls me. We talk about the game, or we talk about the broadcast, like how'd you handle this moment? What would you do in that moment? So it's very fun. He's having a blast. He's a great young man, which is the thing I'm proudest of. He's very respectful of everybody he works with and for, and everything the coaches and players tell me is he's doing great, which he should. He's a very mature young man, and it's fun. I try to give him space at the ballpark. Like, who wants their dad there all the time, right? When you're doing a job. So, I give him as much space as I can. But I'm lucky that we have so much in common and we get along as well as we do.
Have you ever envisioned being in the same booth at the same time calling a game? Who would be the analyst, though?
Well, that's the thing. We do the same job, so. I don't think that could ever happen. I mean, for fun, they could ask me to sit in on a radio game if they wanted to, because radio can have two play-by-play announcers. We've done it twice. He was the announcer for the Barrie BayCats in the Intercounty Baseball League. I want to say it's before COVID, 2018 or 2019. And I wasn't working on Father's Day that day, and he did the broadcast by himself. He was a one-man band. And so I said to him, "Hey, I'm not doing anything. How about letting the old man drive up to Barrie with you?" So we did nine innings together
Wow,
that
that's cool.
day. Yeah, and then 2022, he was the voice of the Fort Wayne Tin Caps, the San Diego Padres A-ball team in the Midwest League. And I was in Detroit with the Blue Jays, and we had an off day, a Thursday or whatever, and it was like a 2.5 hour drive. So I drove down to Fort Wayne just to see him. I hadn't seen him in months because he was there and I was not
Yeah,
there.
of
And
course.
I sat in the booth for like two innings. And I didn't really, I guess I was the analyst. We just chatted really. I don't think I called the game. I think he called the whole game, but I was just kind of there being a nuisance. So we've done it twice. I don't know if it'll ever happen again. If it did, I'd be honored and I'd have fun. And maybe down the road it can happen. But just I'm just enjoying watching him. He does basketball in the winter too. He does the 905 team, the G League. He's done some FIBA stuff for Sportsnet too, and he loves doing that. So I'm just enjoying watching his career progress.
Well, I'm rooting for maybe next year a Father's Day kind of son and father game for the Blue Jays or something like that, whether radio or whatever. And anyways, Dan, thanks so much for taking the time and doing this. And I always appreciate you coming on. And hopefully in 4 years we can do this again in Canada's, maybe getting a medal or something like that. But and that the Jays have won a World Series or something along those lines.
Those would both be nice. I know it feels like a long time until the next cycle's really going to gear up. And I know there's stuff this winter that you have to go through, the qualifiers for the Americas, et cetera, but it feels like it's going to be a long time until that, it's really going again. But yeah, hopefully the time goes by fast.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and we'll do this again, and have a great rest of your Blue Jays marathon, as they say, and
All right.
enjoyed it.
Thanks, Alex.
Hopefully, yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.